Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Vanished ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
There was no sign of Lori. And in that time period, if she had been on the road, there would have been a sign. I mean, they would have found her or somebody picked her up. So the police were called. They came out. They treated it, of course, as if she had somehow gotten confused and wandered off, because we couldn't fathom that anything bad would have happened to her. There were goats and chickens and cows, but not very many people. And it's the morning after Christmas, so there's not even much traffic. So they got together a search team and canvassed the area, talked to neighbors, asked if they had seen this woman, got her name on the news that night. I did an interview with them after dark that first night, saying how Lori could whistle loud and liked to, but always was told not to. But if she was ever lost, she could whistle and we would know where she was. And so I walked around for a long while, giving my own loud whistle, not hearing any response. And this is one of my fears, but it's been realized. She didn't know a stranger. She didn't understand danger. And if somebody would offer her a ride, she'd probably take it. And in fact, we believe that's pretty much what happened that morning. Beyond that, it's also possible that she asked for a ride. Lori attended an adult daycare facility in a nearby town, Monday through Friday. She loved that place. And in fact, she referred to it as her work, and we also called it her work. It was very important to her to go. And in fact, she would have gone to that facility 7 days a week if it was available. And so that particular day, she very much wanted to go to work. It was Monday, after all, the day after Christmas. But because it was the day after Christmas, the center, in fact, was closed. She was disappointed that she couldn't go to work that day. And in fact, what her caregiver said to her is, why don't you instead walk up to the cabin and help Trish, which is me, and you can help her up there. And she said, okay. That's when she left the farmhouse to walk up to where I was at the cabin. She had done this many, many times, so this was not an unusual event whatsoever.
On December 26, 2016, 58-year-old Lori Feltz disappeared from Cynthiana, Kentucky. When Lori was young, she was in a terrible car accident. The accident killed her younger brother, who was a passenger in the vehicle. And Lori suffered a traumatic brain injury that would change the course of her life forever. Lori, as a result of this injury, had intellectual disabilities, short-term memory loss, seizures, and required a caregiver to help her with her daily tasks and make sure she took her medication. Around 9 a.m. on December 26, 2016, Lori was last seen leaving her house on Hickhardy Road to walk up a path to go help her sister at the home next door. The path was only about 300 yards, and this was a route that she would take on a regular basis for exercise. However, she never made it to see her sister. Her sister Trisha was expecting Lori and became concerned when she didn't arrive, but she couldn't find Lori anywhere. Lori's family members believe that it's possible that she became disoriented on her walk and flagged down a passing motorist to ask for a ride. But so far, there have been no signs or clues to indicate what truly happened to Lori that day. I'm Marissa, and from Wondery, this is episode 171 of The Vanished, Lori Feltz's story. Everyone knows that finding the perfect t-shirt can be a challenge. I've always had problems whether it was with the fit or quality. Luckily, the perfect t-shirt does exist, and you can find it at Skims. From cropped silhouettes to long-sleeve layering tees, there's a style for everyone. You know that I've been wearing Skims for a long time, and recently tried one of their t-shirts. It's the best fitting tee I've ever worn. Skims makes the best basics and foundations. I got the boyfriend t-shirt in Onyx, and it's so soft and comfortable. I want to wear it every day. It literally fits like a dream. Shop the Skims t-shirt shop at skims.com, now available in sizes extra, extra small to 4X. If you haven't yet, be sure to let them know I sent you. After you place your order, select podcast in the survey and select my show in the drop-down menu that follows. Now back to the show. For this episode, we had the opportunity to speak with Lori's three sisters, Trisha, Melissa, and Kathleen. Each provided the story from their own perspective and gave unique insights as to who Lori was throughout the duration of her life up until the day she went missing. But before we get into the details of what happened the day Lori disappeared, I would like to go back in time and learn more about Lori as she grew up and what she was like before her life-altering accident. Here's Lori's sister Kathleen speaking about their childhood.
Well, to talk about Lori, she was my older sister by 1 year. There were six kids in our family born in 7 years. So we were all very close. And I just always looked up to my sister, and it would always be, we'd play house together. She was always mom. I was always baby. And growing up then in middle school and high school, you know, I'd take her clothes sometimes or she'd wear mine because we were only a year apart. And we just were very close. She was very independent. From when we were little kids, she got mad at something that mom and dad or mom had said and said, "Come on, we're running away." And she grabbed my hand and we walked down the sidewalk, and I was confused and saying, "But it's almost lunchtime." And she was mad. So we walked and walked, and we got to the end of the block, and she was going to cross the street. And I said, "We're not allowed to cross the street." So we turned, and we ended up doing that a number of times, and we ended up back home, at which time we went in because I was hungry and I talked Lori into it. She was always one for adventure or asserting herself. And I grounded her. And it really kind of remained that way for a long time.
When we spoke to Melissa, one of Lori's other sisters, she had a similar point of view of Lori, but describes her more as the wild child of the family.
She was always just really adventurous, and always she was very into her friends. And as an adolescent, she hung out with a lot of guys, and she was really a beautiful young woman. I admired her, and I was always just sort of in awe because she was going out. She was one of the ones that, like, first was out of the family. Like, she didn't hang out at home. She was very social and very much into going out with her friends and listening to music. And, you know, it was the 70s, of course. As an adolescent, I was like admiring of her, but we didn't spend that much time together necessarily because she was a few years older and definitely into makeup and boys and dressing. And I was kind of, I was more of a nerd, you know. I wore glasses and had braces and wanted to be in school and like to read and that sort of a thing. And Lori was just like exotic and cool. And we didn't, you know, necessarily hang out. And she pretty quickly ran crosswise with my parents and with school. You know, she was a rebel, you know, but basically she was just kind of a wild adolescent. And so she, at some point, left, or I think my mom sent her to live with our grandmother out in California, Palm Springs area. She came home, and it was a big, big deal when she came home because we were celebrating that she was back. I was in junior high school, and we had done some prank, and because it was the last day of school or it was the last week of school or something. I'm talking like I was maybe in the eighth grade. I was not very much of a troublemaker. I was certainly a rebel and had opinions, but I hadn't gotten in trouble at school. Anyway, involved in a prank, got caught, and they suspended me. The school suspended me for the last day or last 2 days of school or something. And it was pretty devastating to me because that's where you were. The last day of school is when you hung out with all your friends. And anyway, Lori had come home from Palm Springs, and she was just super supportive of me. Like, I was crying and sad, and she just played the older sister role. Like, you know, they're so wrong, and we're not going to let them get away with this. And I remember being so grateful that she was supportive. Our parents, with that many kids, and our parents were splitting or absent quite a lot. My dad worked a lot. My mom worked, and they were also really in the process of separating. Their relationship was not good. So the upshot of that was that we were really left to our own means. So Lori's support in that little junior high school moment time was all the support I was going to get. It's not like my mom was going to sit me down and ask me what happened and talk me through it or whatever.
As Melissa previously stated, the family was going through a rough patch during this time. Their parents were in the process of separating. Lori had moved to California, and things were slightly strained. However, Lori would return home to go on a family vacation.
She came with us on a family trip. It was kind of an important family trip because I think our parents had already announced their pending divorce, and my dad wanted to take the kids on a big trip to the Southwest, which we did, but not all the kids went. I think that Joe, the oldest brother, was already in just enough trouble that he might have been out of the house. Kathy wanted to stay with her boyfriend at the time, who's downstairs right now, her husband of 40 years. But Lori came, and it was a difficult time, and I didn't know this until much later, so she was sick a lot on this trip, and then Dad wound up having to fly her home from some portion. We wound up heading out to Colorado, Arizona, and, you know, it was a Southwest trip. I find out later that she was pregnant with Vince. He was a real bad boy in our neighborhood. Vince's baby, and was miscarrying. You know, part of that is an indication of, number one, how naive I was. The idea that we were sisters together and she wasn't sharing that is a part of how she kept to herself, but also how we were not that tight. Like, she somehow couldn't tell me or admit to me what was going on. I didn't understand the gravity of it or the pain that she was in. I remember just thinking it was like she was on her period and she was always so mean and always so, you know, she was withdrawing. But it was a tough time for her. She moved then up to Milwaukee with my dad, and again, another effort at kind of pulling herself together, and was really just starting her life. She had gotten a small job, I think, at my dad's law firm, and was going to be starting nursing school. But, you know, it was just kind of breaking away from the whole Ohio scene and a chance at starting more of a life in Milwaukee when she and my brother were in an accident driving back from Milwaukee to Dayton. But I did idolize her. And one of the reasons they were driving back, and I've struggled like my whole life with this weird guilt, was I had tickets to a concert. I think it was the Eagles. I'm not sure. It was some like really big group in Cincinnati that we were going to drive to. I had bought a ticket for my sister Lori and I to go. And it was a certain amount of cred too for me, like that my beautiful older sister was going to go with me and my friends to a concert. It was like a big deal. It was definitely a big deal. The weird guilt thing was that she was trying to get back to Ohio at that particular time on that particular day because we had these concert tickets.
The accident that Melissa mentioned would be an event that would change the course of Lori's life and her family forever. Kathleen was able to provide us with more details as to what occurred on the day of the accident.
At age 18, I was planning on getting married, and Lori was going to drive home for my bridal shower. And this was in March, and I was to be married in May. And my little brother was up here visiting my dad, and so he got a ride home with Lori instead of taking his flight that had already been purchased for him. He was 14. They were driving home. They got to as far as Indianapolis. There was some icing of the roads that was happening, and a vehicle going the other direction crossed over the median, lost control, and hit him head on. It was just a catastrophic accident. And my brother was basically dead on arrival of the paramedics. And Lori had been sort of choked by her seatbelt because the car had flipped a few times and her body was shifted. So she was left with traumatic brain injury. She was in a coma for a couple of months, and so was not able to be in my wedding. But she had to learn everything all over again, and did. Little by little, her personality was different. Her short-term memory was greatly affected. So she sort of was more like a kid. But she ended up being a very happy and loving person, and didn't know a stranger, and survived in Milwaukee at some not so great halfway houses before we found a good family to care for her up here.
We all know there are things in life that you have to compromise on, but when it comes to your health, there's no compromise. So don't settle for that one doctor that isn't really addressing your needs. Instead, check out ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable. And you can even search by location, availability, and insurance. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. Once you find the doc you want, you can book them immediately. You can filter specifically for ones who take your insurance, are located near you, and treat basically any condition you're searching for. The typical wait time to see a doctor booked on ZocDoc is between just 24 and 72 hours. That's it. I use this, and you should too. Go to ZocDoc.com/vanished and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/vanished. ZocDoc.com/vanished. Imagine upgrading your wardrobe with luxury essentials at unbeatable prices. Quince is here to transform the way you shop with a range of high-quality items priced within reach, like 100% Mongolian cashmere sweaters for $50, organic cotton sweaters, washable silk tops, and timeless 14-karat gold jewelry. The best part, all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to us. And I was thrilled to learn that Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices and premium fabrics and finishes. I love that. I now have several items from Quince. I love their cardigans, pants, and shirts. I find their pieces to be easy to mix and match, and also to dress up or dress down. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/vanished for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/vanished to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/vanished. After the accident, Lori spent time in halfway houses and would eventually return to live with her father for a period of time. Given the fact that Lori had a traumatic brain injury, her mood, temperament, and personality had changed. In addition to grieving the loss of their brother and son, the family also struggled to acclimate to Lori's new challenges. Here's Melissa discussing the difficulties that went along with caring for Lori after the accident, and how Lori eventually left their father's home to receive care that her family was not equipped to give her at the time.
I was living in Milwaukee for that first few months where I lived with my dad and my sister. You know, it was kind of tough. I wasn't very patient with her. And it was also a tough time for my dad where when he did finally decide that we couldn't really care for her well at home. And then I went off to college. I moved to Madison. And the truth is my interaction with her was really pretty limited for the next 15 years, maybe, or 20 years. I was in and out of Milwaukee. So I interacted with her when I was living in Milwaukee. But I basically at some point moved to the Southwest. I mean, I do actually remember when I moved to the Southwest. In the mid-80s, I moved down to Arizona, and between Arizona, Texas, and New Mexico, I essentially never came back to the Midwest until just a couple of years ago. Our adult lives were spent separately, although we always, always had Sundays set up for phone calls. Lori wanted to, you know, liked to be in touch with us as we could. And it was one of the things that she did on Sundays was make phone calls essentially to every member of the family, one after another. She wasn't very good at conversation. You know, the calls would be essentially a scripted, like, so how are you? And what's the weather like? And, you know, not really an exchange, but just hearing the voice and telling stories. You did most of the talking, and she would laugh or ask sort of her scripted questions like, did you enjoy it? And that sort of thing.
Around this time, while Lori was in her mid to late 20s, she met a man named Bob Feltz. Bob and Lori struck up a relationship. Her family wasn't certain if this was the right decision for Lori. They weren't sure if they should have stopped her from this type of relationship given her brain injury. Despite their hesitancy towards the situation, Lori went on to marry Bob, and they shared a life together for many years.
Bob definitely wanted a wife, and they must have had physical relationship, you know, sexual relationship. But this sort of odd thing where were we protecting her enough, or should we have intervened? But she seemed happy, and none of us talked about it. Again, it was also like the 70s and 80s, and like you didn't, you know, talk about thing. And it was her shot at having kind of a, you know, quote unquote, normal life. She was independent because he could be her caregiver. There was no more foster care and living in institutions and all of the above. So it was a good shot. And my dad stayed close, and Bob and Lori stayed in touch with my dad. My dad was always the medical decision maker until he turned that over to me a few years ago. But at that point, I was in and out of being in contact with them. But during a stay in Milwaukee, I was involved with a local newspaper, a free weekly alternative newspaper. What Bob was doing for a trade was started his own business, I'm sure with support, and it was great, a small print shop. It was called B&L Graphics. Bob named it with his first initial and Lori's initial, and then graphics. And it was long before there was the ability to print as easily as it, you know, when a print shop could still make a business. And I got the newspaper, which is, you know, needed to be published on a weekly basis, and is now a huge, called the Shepherd Express in Milwaukee. At the time, it was just a college-based kind of radical newspaper called the Crazy Shepherd. Bob and Lori in their little print shop printed the weekly newspaper. They got that contract, or because I was a part of the group that started that newspaper, was able to hand them that contract. And it was a pretty cool thing because it helped them keep the business going. The other thing that I know they enjoyed doing was they did like square dancing. You know, they had certain things that they did every week, that square dancing was one of them. Bob got cancer, was diagnosed with cancer, and I think during the course of a year, his life was over. And it was at that point that my dad arranged with to put Lori in the care of the state and with a state of Wisconsin, and she became a ward of the state and was placed in foster care in Sheboygan with a family up there. It never seemed like the best situation. It was just the only situation that we had.
The foster family that Lori stayed with after her husband Bob passed away was a nice family, but different from the type in which Lori had grown up with. After a while, Lori began to gain weight while staying with this family and was not as active as she had been for the entirety of her life. The weight gain affected Lori's mobility, and she had a tendency to fall down. As she grew older, she would experience issues with her legs and ankles. Over time, Lori began to miss the feeling of being around her family. Here's Kathleen discussing Lori's eventual move to her sister Trisha's home.
Eventually, what we kept hearing from Lori is, as nice as this family was, that was caring for her, they weren't family. And we had always been family, you know, very close. So she missed being living with family. And my sister, who was a retired police officer, had decided that she would take care of Mom because Mom was in a nursing home up in Ohio near me, had Alzheimer's and needed care that was getting more and more expensive each month, it seemed. And so Trisha, actually, who lived in this beautiful log home on a hill, bought the farmhouse down the hill next to her to use as a care house. My husband and I went down there and redid, you know, knocked out some walls and made it so that it was a good setup for caregivers and for Trisha and her husband to still have the upstairs. And since Trisha was already having caregivers help her with Mom, she thought it would be wonderful if she could reunite Mom and Lori. Because when Mom and Lori would get on the phone with each other, Lori would always say, you know, like, I just want to come see you. And Mom would say, I want you to come see me, or I'll come see you. And they would both get worked up, but Mom couldn't take care of herself, and neither could Lori. So we ended up getting Lori down there to live and found a adult daycare center where she could go, and she thought she was there to help. And so she called it her work.
Here's Lori's sister Trisha describing her home in Cynthiana, Kentucky.
So we live on a rural farm in Nicholas County, Kentucky, and it's a 50-acre farm. It's very private. She was walking on the farm, which was not unusual at all for her to do. In fact, there's two homes on the farm, and they are about a football field distance apart from each other. And she very often walked between the two homes back and forth. We often walked it together. It was they are connected by a gravel driveway.
Trisha went on to explain the events of the day leading up to the moment that Lori went missing.
So on the morning of Monday, December 26th, 2016, she was supposed to be walking from what we call the farmhouse to the cabin. She, because of her needs, we did have a caregiver who assisted in getting her ready for the day. I was at the cabin. Lori was at the farmhouse with her caregiver, and Lori set out to walk from the farmhouse to the cabin. That was our understanding. Lori never arrived at the cabin. So within 15 minutes, I was watching for her to arrive to the cabin and couldn't see her. And for you to understand the layout, it's kind of a straight shot. You can look from the cabin all the way down the gravel lane, basically almost to the farmhouse, and see the whole lane. And I didn't see her. I immediately texted her caregiver, thinking that maybe she had turned back, maybe like she had to go to the bathroom or something. And her caregiver immediately texted back, no, you know, she left here to walk there, and she's not here. So both of us, both she and I, immediately set out to look for her, knowing that she would not be far. Lori was about 5'9", 230 pounds. So she was a large woman, but she had several health issues. Her weight being one of her health issues, it caused her to walk slowly. She also had an artificial knee. She also had edema, swelling in both ankles. And a couple of years previously, she had also broken one of her ankles. And so she had a pin and a screw and a plate in that ankle. So she didn't go anywhere fast, which was fine. We just wanted her walking. So I knew that wherever she was, we would catch up with her. And a very quick search of the area, including the roadway, we didn't find her. So I immediately called the sheriff.
The sheriff responded immediately to the scene, and the search for Lori began at once.
The sheriff responded very quickly. We were impressed. And within the hour, he had garnered a significant search party. It was actually a huge search party. He also called in, Nicholas County is a small rural county, so he actually called in resources from 19 different counties. So within just a few hours, we had people there from all over, EMTs, search and rescue, people on foot, people on horseback, people in ATVs, people with search dogs, dogs that were trained for article scent, dogs that were trained for tracking, even cadaver dogs, even a helicopter. It was a massive search and rescue response. They searched that day, they searched the following day, bringing in even more resources. They searched the day after that. Basically, they searched for 5 days, and they called off the search.
When the searches all came up empty, they began to wonder if this was more than Lori just being lost, and if a crime had been committed.
The sheriff is Bubba Siles, and when we started fearing that we had a crime scene that was being trampled by horses and four-wheelers and fire trucks and all the people who were searching, we ended up getting it switched from the local sheriff to Kentucky State Troopers. And Tricia handled that because of being a police officer. She knew how to go about requesting it or something.
Given what we know about Lori and the physical limitations she lived with, how could it be that she seemingly vanished into thin air? Lori's family has a few theories as to what could have happened to her. Kathleen informed us of an interaction that an officer had with one of Trisha's neighbors, Penny Snap.
So then the assumption was somebody picked her up. But in the first day or two of the search, in one of the neighbors, they had knocked on this cabin door, and this is a house that did not have running water or electricity. We had a generator. and nobody was answering. Well, I do believe people were home, but they weren't answering the door. But then the police saw there was a shed and a path from that house to the shed where they could see smoke coming up. So they walked the path and went to the shed, and the door was just a little bit ajar, and they glanced in. It was just one police officer. He saw two guys in there, two mattresses with bedding, and some, I don't know if it was a stove or a barrel or some sort of heat source that they were sitting around. He said it was dark in there and they had their hoodies up, so he didn't really get a close look at them. And he asked if they had seen this person. They said no, and he didn't get their names, and he moved on. After that, at some point, they found out that that particular neighbor has a son who was a convicted sex offender in Colorado and had been recently on the news with being one of the top 10 most wanted, I don't know if it's criminals or sex offenders or whatever, but they had some sort of thing that they would then play over and over on TV. So he was out there and decided to go further into hiding. And he went down to Kentucky and was hiding in that outbuilding with a friend of his who was also convicted child sex offender. And the mother was allowing them to live in the shed hidden. They both were on parole for a while and kept violating their parole. And so at some point, they were listed as failure to register. And when the police went looking for them, they couldn't find them. So now they're hiding in Kentucky and happen to be there the day that my sister went missing. But none of that means that they did do anything to Lori. However, when the police were down around, you know, like looking around for Lori and asking neighbors, they happened to see something that indicated a marijuana grow operation and turned that information over to the DEA. And DEA came out and found that and arrested Penny. And when the prosecuting attorney was talking to Penny Snapp about her charges, her attorney was by her side, and the prosecuting attorney said to Penny, "Now, we've got these charges here, but if you could shed some light, you know, if you have any information about the Lori Feltz case, you know, perhaps we could work something out." The prosecuting attorney said she almost didn't even have those last words out of her mouth before Penny Snapp leaned in and said, "Can I get full immunity?" And her attorney shut it down right after that. He said, "Penny, this is, we've got minor fines here. It's nothing, you know, we'll just keep your mouth shut and we'll pay the fines and be done." And so they left without sharing any information. So there's reason to believe that mother not only was harboring fugitives, but also was looking for immunity from her own crimes. You know, she would give them some information. The husband, who's not the father, but was at the time married to Penny Snapp, Joshua Snapp, I was told in those first few days, I went out there right away, of course, and stayed with Tricia while we were looking for Lori. And he had supposedly that day, right after the police were called to the house, been out on horseback for about 5 hours. And Penny had said later, you know, he hadn't been on a horse in a long time, but that day he went out to help look for Lori. And he was gone for about 5 hours, and he was so sore the next couple of days that he could hardly move and was on the couch. Now, while that could be just from horseback riding and looking for Lori, it could also be, in my mind, him covering up what had happened. That family property had cameras along the lane, all around the house, and like 8 Rottweilers that would run their property, keeping anybody from wandering in. Husband was an over-the-road trucker, so he would be gone sometimes doing runs, but other than that, then he would be home. I know at one point my suspicion was of Joshua Snap, the husband to Penny, because my husband and I had borrowed some metal detectors, and I was thinking if Lori had gone towards the road, very rural, so probably 15 cars go by in a few hours, but if she had gone to that road and gotten picked up or hit on accident, you know, my mind was thinking if Lori was walking along the road and somebody accidentally hit her or she flagged them down, she would have easily gotten into anybody's car because she was just trusting. At some point, you know, that could have gone wrong for her, and maybe her jewelry or her, she had a medical alert bracelet that she always wore. So I thought maybe we would find some proof that Lori had gone towards the road that would help us in knowing what happened or where to look. And Joshua came down the long, muddy dirt lane and looked at both of us out there with our metal detectors. And I couldn't see his face, but I'm assuming it was Joshua Snap driving at that point. And he peeled out from the gravel and dirt driveway going the other direction, throwing rocks kind of our direction. And it just seemed like a very aggressive thing for him to do. Like, he was angry, and he jumped on that all the way down the road, but it seemed like a very angry, aggressive move for him to make towards us by doing that. And that doesn't seem like somebody who would have just been, you know, being a good neighbor and out searching for this lost woman the day before, or, you know, in the days before. So then I felt like I suspected that he knew something or had done something.
You aren't sleeping and you're stressed out. That's how it was for me, so I cleared out my cabinet and reset my health with CBD from CB Distillery. Their deep sleep gummies are amazing. CB Distillery's targeted formulations are made from the highest quality clean ingredients. No fluff, no fillers, just pure, effective CBD solutions designed to help support your health. In 2 non-clinical surveys, 81% of customers experienced more calm, 80% said CBD helped with pain after physical activity, and an impressive 90% said they slept better with CBD. If you struggle with a health concern and haven't found relief, make the change to CB Distillery. And with over 2 million customers and a solid 100% money-back guarantee, CB Distillery is a source to trust. I have a 20% discount to get you started. Visit cbdistillery.com and use code VANISHED for 20% off. That's cbdistillery.com, code VANISHED. cbdistillery.com. Audible offers thousands of popular favorites, exclusive new series, guided wellness programs, comedy, and exciting new voices in audio. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. The Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere. While traveling, working out, walking, doing chores, you decide. I like to listen a little bit each evening while I'm cooking dinner. And it's great for my evening walks, too. Recently, I've been listening to Lay Them to Rest by Laura Norton. It's a fantastic audiobook. You don't want to miss it. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. That's audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500.
The possibility that Lori got disoriented and flagged down a car is high.
but we can't say for sure that this is exactly what happened, seeing as there's no concrete evidence that this occurred. Trisha did speak of an incident where Lori mistook a neighbor's car for her work bus.
In fact, she has approached other neighbors. My neighbor has told me that one day Lori, you know, flagged her down and said, "Are you my bus? Are you going to take me to work?" And of course, my neighbor said, "No, honey, I'm not your bus. You need to go wait back by your house." Because in fact, the bus that would pick her up would actually drive up our lane and pick her up right in front of the farmhouse. So she never even had to walk towards the roadway. So this is just speculation. What if she did flag down a car? What if she flagged them down and asked for a ride? It's possible. Because I say it's possible because she had done that with a neighbor.
Lori's family strongly believes that Penny Snapp and the two men she was harboring in her shed know more about what happened to Lori. To them, it seems too coincidental that their sister would go missing around the same time that these two individuals were on the run from law enforcement.
I have to say, you know, except for Penny, but all the other neighbors are truly wonderful neighbors. It boggles my mind. Of course, we had no idea she was harboring these two guys back there. And it's also possible that, you know, if these two guys picked her up, that, I don't know, it's hard for me to walk down that line of thinking what they might have thought or what they might have wanted to do. We know that she has been intentionally hidden from us.
Another thing that fuels the family's belief in this theory is that on the Snapp property, there was an area of soil that had been disturbed, as if someone had placed something underneath the dirt.
Detective Larson said he recalls the ground being freshly disturbed when he first responded to the case, to the call, 2 years ago. And I have been jumping up and down, stepping on toes. Why wasn't a search warrant issued? Because you know that you got not necessarily a suspect. Penny's not necessarily a suspect, but she is clearly potentially a material witness. You've caught her in a lie. You know that there were two guys in that shed. You might not know exactly who they were, but you suspect who they were. And there's clearly evidence that they were living in the shed. There was bedding in the shed. There's pots and pans. I mean, not a lot, but like a little chair. They even had like a little battery-powered radio. Obviously, the wood stove. And when they went back to find those two guys, it's as if those two guys up and ran. I mean, like the bedding is still there in kind of disarray. Just literally, it's all right there. And they did not. And I cannot speak to why not, because I have pushed and pushed and pushed. And Chris Markham, who was the initial detective assigned the case, just insisted that he did not have enough evidence. And we argued about that because I said, well, okay, so what you have is circumstantial evidence, but circumstantial is still a legally recognized form of evidence, even though it's not the best form, right? He wouldn't do it. Now, I will say this. The day that Chris Markham took over the case, I clearly remember because he walked in the farmhouse door and I was relieved to see him because he looked professional, clean cut. He looked like I expect a Kentucky State Trooper to look. And so I was feeling very relieved. And I asked him, I said, "Detective Markham, how long have you been a detective?" 6 months, ma'am. My heart just sunk to my stomach. Now, that's not necessarily a bad thing, but when I started seeing things like he didn't feel the need to do polygraphs, he didn't think that he had enough for a search warrant, I started seeing it as a real problem.
To this day, Kathleen still finds the behavior of the neighbors to be suspicious. She told us more about a recent search that was conducted.
Once the police put together that this sex offender from Colorado was now all over the news out there and nowhere to be found, they thought, well, his mother lives right next to Tricia. And turns out there were two guys in the shed that were there that were questioned. So then they thought, well, we'll go back and ask Penny and Joshua Snap, you know, who were the two young men that were staying in the outbuilding. And Penny and Joshua looked at them and said, we don't know what you're talking about. Nobody stays here but us. And the police knew that wasn't true because they had, you know, talked to the two guys. So they knew then that Penny and Joshua were going to lie about the fact these two were there. Then there was something else that happened that the police had additional reason to believe that they had seen Joshua Snap in the area, had documented that he was indeed in the area. So there's circumstantial evidence of Penny asking for immunity, Penny and Joshua lying to the police, the fact that Joshua was out on horseback right after Lori disappeared, supposedly looking for her. And then there were subsequent searches with accredited search dogs that were hitting all around that property. But Joshua had early on gotten mad at a searcher who was on his property and told them to get off. He didn't want any more searchers on his property unless they had a warrant. Well, they never got a warrant. Lately, I think in the last 6 weeks or so, our private investigator working with the state troopers now instead of the local sheriff had arranged for a search with dogs and had gotten permission from Joshua Snap, who's now divorced from Penny and back in Kentucky. And they did a search. The dogs hit on an area and they had heard stories from some of their informants and family members out in Colorado, something about a car that had been torched and then buried on the property, and that there might be a body in the trunk. And they did indeed find the car, I believe, but no body. I didn't ever get to talk to the police about what exactly they found. All I was told is there was no body found. But the fact that 2 years went by, I mean, physical evidence is hard to come by. And then to make matters even worse, when they went and looked in the shed and it was totally cleared out, like nothing on their farm or on their land is cleared out. It's all filled with junk and trash and whatever. But this one shed is completely cleared out.
One theory that's been tossed around is if Lori could have seen something that piqued her interest and she wandered off, getting lost in the process. Kathleen doesn't feel like this is likely.
Well, the main reason that we do not believe that that would happen is that we had to really encourage Lori to move, like to get up out of the chair. Or sometimes when I'd be visiting, I'd say, look at that horse in the field. Let's walk over to see it. Just trying to get her moving. And she would say, well, you go ahead. I'll just stay here. But if you asked her, like Tricia, to get her moving, would also call the caregiver and say, could you ask Lori to bring a can of soup up to the cabin? And Lori would be thrilled to have a task. So she would put a bag in Lori's hand with a can of soup and send her up to the cabin. And it would take Lori a while, but she would make it. And she would stay and visit with Trish for a while Trisha was cleaning. And then Trisha would say, Morgan at the farmhouse said she needed a can of soup. And so she would hand her the bag. And Lori, having bad short-term memory, didn't recall that she had carried that up. And she would gladly walk back down there. But she had bad knees, bad feet, bad hips, was overweight, and easily winded, and did not like to walk. She wouldn't have walked very far voluntarily. She was fairly weak when it came to endurance, and we were working on that, but would have been difficult. But she wouldn't have walked far, and she wouldn't have walked off any path. Although, given the fact that there was sometimes seizure activity, a seizure could have happened. But, you know, if she had wandered into a field or into any area out there, the searchers, which included a couple of days after her disappearance, included a helicopter, they would have located her.
We asked Tricia if she believes that Lori could still be alive out there somewhere.
Yeah, she's not alive. Her medical conditions, she required medication to be taken not only daily, but on a rigid schedule throughout the day. Four times a day, she took significant doses of anti-seizure medication because the brain injury did cause epilepsy. And so she potentially could have seizures if she didn't take her medication.
Lori's family has dealt with so much loss over the years, with the passing of their brother in the accident that left Lori with a brain injury, and then years later, Lori disappearing. For their older brother, Joe, it all became too much. He told Melissa about how he was struggling.
This was a couple of weeks after, maybe three, after my sister's disappearance, and I pulled up in Pewaukee, and my brother was sitting outside having a cigarette on the bench in front of that house, and he looked like he was, I could tell that he was really, really distraught. Anyway, so was I. You know, it was just a super high stress time, and he stood up, and we just put our arms around each other. And it was the only time that I'd seen him break down. My brother, I don't think I'd ever seen him cry, ever. In fact, I know it's the only time in our lives that I saw him cry. He said, "I've been having these terrible nightmares." And that's the other word that I would say, not just distraught, but like haunted. Like there was something really off with Joe. And I mean, I put my arms around him in part just because like I could see he was falling apart, and I didn't quite understand what was happening. And I, you know, like, anyway, he said to me then, "I don't know I cannot handle this." In fact, he was almost like he was saying things that I remembered thinking that he must have taken different meds or something. Like he didn't say sentences correctly or something. Like it was something that made me think he was off, but I just held him. And then he started sobbing, which really, like I said, it's just, I'd never happened before. And I just kept holding him. And he said, "You know, I was always in charge of you kids." He was the oldest, obviously the eldest brother, and took care of us when we were kids. And he said, "I was always supposed to protect you guys. I'm supposed to protect you guys. And now Lori is gone and there is not a goddamn thing I can do. I can't protect you. And I don't know what to do." He was just beside himself, you know. And he said, "I haven't slept in days because I have these nightmares. And they're like vivid, vivid nightmares. And over and over and over again, Lori's dying and being beaten. And you're all dying. And I can't do anything about it. I can't live like this. Like, I can't, like, I'm terrified."
Joe had struggled with addiction over the years. He had periods where he did really well and then would end up relapsing. Sadly, the family faced yet another tragedy when Joe passed away from an overdose during the summer following Lori's disappearance.
So when my brother died, I was the one that really took charge of dealing with, because I was there. You know, I was in Madison. I could get to Milwaukee. And Tricia and Cass were both both farther away and absorbed in things around Lori's case. So I was kind of the kid who handled Joe's death, I feel like. At least in my mind, that's how it was, and tried to support my dad through it.
So what happened to Lori Feltz on December 16th, 2016? Did she simply become disoriented due to her traumatic brain injury and wandered off and just hasn't been found? Or did she fall victim to an unthinkable act at the hands of her neighbors? There are so many possibilities and missing pieces to this puzzle. We may never truly know the answer to any of these questions. Lori Feltz was last seen on December 26, 2016 in Cynthiana, Kentucky. At the time of her disappearance, she was 58 years old. She was 5 foot 9 inches tall and weighed around 230 pounds. She has red hair and blue eyes. She was last seen wearing a winter coat that went down to her knees, a green shirt and dark colored pants. She had a medical bracelet on her right wrist that gave her name and contact information. If you have any information regarding the disappearance of Lori Feltz, please call the Kentucky State Police at 859-428-1212.
And it's been very, very painful to talk about because we know now that she's been murdered and we've not found her body yet. So the accident occurred in 1978. She was very lucky to have survived that accident. My younger brother did not survive, but she sustained a traumatic brain injury that disabled her for the rest of her life. So she's always needed care, and
through this, I think there were a number of missed opportunities. There is a possibility that Lori disappeared or was picked up by somebody. She would have not lived very long without all of her medications and all of the help that she needed. But that was our first guess after we realized she didn't just walk away, or else she would have been found because the searches were pretty thorough. And so it was either somebody picked her up or somebody did something.
That brings us to the end of episode 171. I'd like to thank Kathleen, Melissa, and Trisha for speaking to us for this episode. Special thanks to Jay Klein and Patty Scott, who work in the field of disability advocacy and took the time to consult with us for this episode. If you have a missing loved one that you'd like to have featured on the show, there's a case submission form at thevanishedpodcast.com. If you'd like to contact me, there's a page and a discussion group on Facebook. I'm on Twitter at The Vanished Pod and also on Instagram. If you enjoy this show, subscribe now and leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Wondery.com, or wherever you're listening right now. Do you want to help support the show? There are a couple things that you can do. One way to help The Vanished is by supporting our sponsors. You can find links and promo codes in the episode notes. Another way to support the show is by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey. Join me next time. I'll be covering a case from Maine. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to the small town of Chinook, where faith runs deep and secrets run deeper. In this new thriller, available exclusively on Wondery Plus, religion and crime collide when a gruesome murder rocks the isolated Montana community. Everyone is quick to point their fingers at a drug-addicted teenager, but local deputy Ruth Vogel isn't convinced. she suspects connections to a powerful religious group. Enter Federal Agent V.B. Loro, who has been investigating a local church for possible criminal activity. The pair form an unlikely partnership to catch the killer, unearthing secrets that leave Ruth torn between her duty to the law, her religious convictions, and her very own family. But something more sinister than murder is afoot, and someone is watching Ruth. With an all-star cast led by Emmy nominee Sanaa Lathan and Star Wars Kelly Marie Tran, Chinook is available exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
I understand that anybody who's paid attention to the media would have to come to the conclusion that I killed my wife.
Hi, my name is Zach Stewart Pontier. I'm one of the filmmakers behind The Jinx, and I'm excited to bring you the official Jinx podcast. We'll be revisiting all six episodes of Part 1 and watching along with Part 2 as it airs on Max, starting April 21st.
Bye-bye.
The official Jinx podcast. Listen on Max or wherever you get your podcasts.